This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Once again, we are up high in the Rocky Mountains. We are coming to you from the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. We are focusing once again on some of the big ideas in education and learning. Now, you might have heard your parents talk about walking to school in the snow uphill both ways, all the sacrifices they made to get an education. But today we're going to speak with a young woman who literally risked her life to go to school in Afghanistan, and now she's helping others go to school in that country. That's coming up later in the program. But we are going to start today by focusing on innovators in education in this country in their own very different ways. Our next guests are rethinking the way children are learning through technology, music, and work-study programs. Father Joe Parks is president of Cristo Rey New York High School. That's a Catholic high school located in East Harlem. That school constructs the school work, the school week in a very different way than most. Larry Scripp is the founding director and principal researcher for the Center for Music in Education. That's a research and development organization that helps schools develop arts education programs. And Jesse Willie Wilson is CEO of Dreambox Learning. That company develops computer-based learning programs that adapt to individual students. Welcome to you all. I'm so glad you all could be here today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I just want to mention that if you missed your flight or somehow your ticket got misplaced and you didn't make it out to Aspen, you can join the conversation on Twitter. Just use the hashtag NPRAspen. So let me just start with you, Father Joe. Cristo Rey New York High School does things a little differently. As I understand it, your students are in school 4 days a week and that they have a job one day a week. What does that accomplish? What do the students get with that schedule that they wouldn't get otherwise?
Well, two things, Michelle. First of all, the corporate work study program was begun in our first school in Chicago in 1996 solely for financial reasons, so that we could keep the tuition very low because we serve only low-income students. So our tuition in New York is $2,000 a year. We opened in 2004, and we've never raised the tuition. So the idea of the corporate work study program is that five students would share an entry-level clerical job in white-collar firms. To give you an example, we have kids working at J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank, several big law firms, several Aspen Ideas Festival sponsors, such as Mount Sinai Hospital and Thomson Reuters. So five kids share an entry-level clerical job. We charge the companies $31,000 for the 10 months that they have the services of the students. That money comes to the school. So in our school in New York City, 45% of our operating income is earned by the students themselves. But far more important than the financial sustainability that this program gives to our school is the transformative impact that youngsters working in these major firms get from their 4 years' experience. It builds up a tremendous sense of self-esteem and confidence in them. And I like to tell people when our kids come to us, they're behind in grade level by and large, but they're very far ahead of the game in terms of street smarts. And it doesn't take them too long to figure out the people in these companies are no smarter than they are, but they went to school. They know then if they stay in school, they can work in these places, and they know that the companies want them. So it puts to the lie what they hear in their neighborhoods, that education is a waste, you're not going to get a job anyway. And our kids know that's not true. So our first graduates are working at these companies now.
Larry Scripp, a lot of your focus has been on music education. I think a lot of people think of music education as something nice to do if you can afford it. You feel very differently. Tell us a little bit about your program.
Well, as a researcher and a program developer, I start with working with communities with the question, what is the essential role of music and the arts in education? And when you think about that question and you really think hard about the children in front of you, you can begin to understand how important the arts and music are. And so what we do is work with communities to develop practices that involve teaching artists in schools, intensive education within the art form, also the incorporation of integration of music across the curriculum. So arts plus arts integration is really what the practices are now evolving to be. And the successes in Chicago Public Schools with CAPE or in Oakland with the school district, the Mile Project, or in New York with the Center for Arts Education, all have in common research questions that can be answered by practices developed on intensive education in the arts.
Well, what is your argument, though, or is your sort of fundamental point of view that music education isn't is essential as reading and as math? Because I think a lot of people would say, well, that's nice to do, but if the kids can't read and can't do math, what's the point? Is your view that it's just as important?
There are no false. It's a false argument to pit one against the other. What I did when I started my charter school, the Conservatory Lab Charter School, which has now gone on to become a proven provider in Massachusetts and now a convener of the and a developer of the El Sistema program in the U.S. there, that when I first started that school and went before the State Board of Education, I said, I have as many hours dedicated to musical arts instruction as language arts. That was the experiment. That's what charter schools are supposed to do, I thought. We're laboratories for change. What will happen if our children are as literate in music as they are in language arts and math, by the way? And so the experiment is run, and at first, the children were immediately scoring as well as in the mid-ground as many Boston public schools. But the education itself completely is different. And when we compare, when that charter school compares itself to other charter schools who might score higher in terms of academic scores, but have higher rates of student attrition and no joy in the classroom. Now we begin to know, and the parents begin to know, look, it's the quality of education. It's just not just the test scores. And we can show that through taking music that seriously. Intensive practice, intensive understanding, but music as a literacy, not just as a talent show.
We want to hear from you, Jesse Willie Wilson. We need to take a break in a minute, but before we do, we certainly want to hear from you. You are the CEO of Dreambox Learning, and your company specializes in adaptive learning technology. What is that?
Well, we have developed an intelligent adaptive learning engine that personalizes learning in a supreme way. Essentially, we collect data, about 50,000 data points per student per hour, so that we can, and not only about what are they getting right and what are they getting wrong, but also the strategies that they're using to solve problems. So we're actually measuring how they're thinking, and we're using that to personalize the learning.
At what age does this start, and at what age does this go? And do the students spend most of the day by themselves doing this, or
how does it work? This is a complementary math curriculum, so it is pre-K through grade 6 right now. And it is not something that is 100%, you know, they don't spend all their time on a computer. But what we do is we allow teachers to manage increasingly large classrooms with increasing a diversity of learners by separating kids into smaller groups. Some are on Dreambox Learning, others are in live instruction, and they rotate.
You know, it's interesting because we've been getting a lot of tweets as we were getting ready to go on the air, and a lot of the questions that a lot of the people have, and many of them are teachers, is how do you diversify learning and how do you adapt the learning experience to each child's needs in an era when classroom sizes are getting larger and when kids are coming from all different kinds of perspectives. We also heard a tweet from Monica Oliveira using the handle @LatinMommy, and she says, you know, what about homeschooling? You can teach your kids according to the way they learn best. What do you think about that, Jesse?
So we're bringing the worlds together. The formal and structured world in a classroom is being linked through these cloud-based technologies to what happens in a home. And so it's an artificial separation. So right now what we're doing is we know how kids are solving problems. We know, as a result of that, what they need in order to move ahead.
How does this square with the fact that parents have been told since screens started to become more affordable, limit screen time, how does that square with the message? It seems like it's kind of making a confusing message there.
It's a false choice again. Yeah. I think we're trying to close the gap, really, between the way kids are living and the way they're learning today. So kids are having technology all over their real lives, they would say. And then most kids, when they go to school, we lose them. We don't think they're engaged. And one of the reasons is we are not talking to them and relating to them how they're used to learning. They're learning every day with technology. We can't hide it from them.
You know, Larry, I want to go back to you. A number of you have mentioned the idea of false choice, that it isn't necessarily a conflict between what we have come to understand about education and what actually works well and what we're finding out about what works well. But I did want to ask you, where's the pushback coming from? Is there any on your ideas? I mean, I think a lot of people, for generations, educated people have sought access to music. It's kind of a fundamental part of life. But as budgets get tighter, a lot of people say, well, I just can't afford that. So where does the pushback come from in your world?
Surprisingly, some of the pushback came from arts educators who wanted to protect the isolation of the arts. The arts is to itself. It shouldn't be taught for integration. It should be something that children just learn to do. And so the idea of arts plus arts integration was a pushback for them. For the general educators, it was really a matter of understanding what the arts really are and what they really do and how accessible, utterly accessible, they are to all adults. For example, as an educated adult, I can show within a few minutes that you can process music notation, because we do understand quantification. We understand fundamental concepts of music, proportion, reversibilities. The ability to represent and invent representations of music is what our children do, and what adults need to see their children doing to understand that it's utterly accessible. The other thing, the pushback became on the gifted education versus education for all kids. The amount of money and tracking that goes into talent, and I teach at Newman Conservatory, so I know what these students are like. They are not coming from the mindset of a general education with music included. They're coming with a certain amount of ideas about innate talent. By the time they get through with Newman Conservatory, they don't think that way anymore. And that the idea of innate talent is the enemy of education policy.
Father Joe, I haven't forgotten you. We need to take a short break in a minute. But Larry Scripp, just before we do, is it the do as I say, not as I do situation? Do you play?
I do.
What do you play?
I grew up in a house with a big band in it.
And okay, that's great.
So I spoke the language of music. And, you know, I have to say something about that. My family was in the Navy, and we went to school after school after school. My music education came with me. I wasn't so sure the math was.
We are following the education conversation on Twitter at hashtag NPR Aspen. We hope you'll stay with us as we continue our special broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival. We are continuing our conversation with education innovators. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, we will hear the story of one young woman who literally put her life on the line to go to school. Shabana Pasij Rasik will join us to talk about growing up under Taliban rule in Afghanistan and the work she's doing now to make sure other young Afghan women can get an education. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we are continuing our conversation with our education innovators. Still with us, our Father Joe Parks. He's president of Cristo Rey New York High School. That's a Catholic high school. It's in East Harlem, New York, which features a non-traditional schedule, 4 days in school, 1 day working. Larry Scripp is the founding director of the Center for Music in Education. That's a research and development organization that helps schools develop arts education programs. And Jesse Willie Wilson is CEO of Dreambox Learning. That company develops computer-based learning programs that adapt to individual students. Before we took our short break, we were talking about where, if any, the pushback comes from. So, Father Joe, I want to know, who doesn't like your big idea?
Well, we had pushback from a couple of foundations who told us early on, you're bringing in low-income kids, giving them a college prep education. You should be keeping them in school 5.5 days a week, not letting them out work 1 day a week. I think we have proven with our rigorous curriculum that was developed over the years by our network, thanks to the Gates Foundation and Bridgespan Consulting, that we're getting our kids ready to succeed in college and to get into great colleges and universities. So in the 6 graduating classes we've had, we've graduated 400 kids. They've already graduated from places such as Swarthmore, Northwestern, Santa Clara, Fordham. We have kids at Georgetown, at Amherst, at Williams, at Smith, at Skidmore, great colleges and universities all over the country. So I think we've proven that the corporate work study program gives our youngsters a tremendous sense of motivation and dedication to succeed in school. And a lot of the research shows that for children from low-income families, the habits they pick up in high school are just as important as the knowledge they pick up in terms of whether or not they'll succeed in college. 90% of our kids attend college. We just graduated 90 youngsters. 77% will be going to private four-year colleges, 21% to public four-year colleges, 2% to public junior colleges. That's 100%. So we've proven that the corporate work study program not only does not detract from their education, it actually improves their education and helps them grow as human beings and gives them a great sense of hope, and they see their futures in it. And that makes education make sense.
Jesse, Willie Wilson, we're getting a lot of tweets from people who are really talking among themselves in some ways about the whole question of the digital divide. And they're asking whether this is another thing. Is this kind of adaptive learning something that would bridge the digital divide, or does it in some ways entrench it yet again? Because the kids who are most likely to have access to this kind of experience are already the kids who are most advantaged. What are you finding, and what do you say about that?
So we believe that we are helping to close that digital divide. And we're doing that by changing expectations of learners. So we have data that shows that kids in very low income backgrounds, many of whom don't speak English as a first language, when they're exposed to the supportive environment, the Dreambox learning environment, they outperform their counterparts dramatically.
Can I just jump in for 1 second? For example, one of the questions we received from a teacher in New Orleans, Valerie Burton, she says that you know, a lot of people are very suspicious about technology in the classroom. She says, for example, the best way for kids in her school to use technology in the classroom would be to use their phones. But guess what? Phones aren't allowed in school.
Yes. And so this is a really important point. And she has healthy skepticism because there's been a lot of failure in education around education technology. But this new kind of technology promises something different because because of the data that is included with it. So children in this environment are able to actually architect their own learning. These are kids that have to learn how to learn. They're going to inherit a world and jobs and industries that don't yet exist. And so we have to get them to remake their skill sets, and we have to give them the abilities and to do that. And with these technologies, many of whom you're actually used to. I mean, so you guys use Amazon and use Netflix, and these are technologies that get to know you. They make suggestions. We've brought that into learning with Dreambox Learning.
Larry, you wanted to say something?
Yes, I'm thinking about what Jesse's saying, and I think we don't need to make a false choice between technology and not technology. We need to make smart choices. In music education, it's peculiarly absent of technology. It's a huge amount of social contact. A huge amount of interaction is needed to go forward. And age groups have to work together and in large ensembles. In this kind of context, I'm wondering how technology would work, because we could sure use data points and find out more about our processes, but we don't want to disembed social process.
Let me just build on that. I mean, so there are three pieces of this. You have to start with a robust curriculum. And so we have that. But you also have to make it engaging so that children will persist through challenge, because they need to build their muscles, their learning muscles, and you do that through strenuous activity. And so we make the environment very fun, but it's still very strenuous. And then the third piece is the data. So what can we learn about the moment? So there are technologies that were on the periphery of learning for a long time. Now these technologies impact learning at the point of instruction, real time. And so kids are getting continuous feedback about making adjustments. And guess what? It's a richer, more rewarding, engaging, and fun learning environment.
Father Joe?
I think it's all about student-centered learning. When I was growing up, learning was teacher-centered. You sat in the classroom and the teacher taught. You took notes. And then you took quizzes and tests and wrote papers. Nowadays, all the emphasis is on student-centered learning. So in our school, we train our teachers very, very effectively. They're visited once a week by the assistant principal or the principal. They're constantly giving feedback. How are you engaging the students in their learning? We use technology not quite as extensively as some other schools, but again, that's another part of student-centered learning. And then our work-study program, our students, we really believe, learn a lot in the workplace because they're given tasks that they have to perform over an 8-hour workday. And they learn a lot from their colleagues at work and from their supervisors about how the real world operates. And yet they're in control of what they're doing each day. That's another example of student-centered learning. So I see the technology piece as one part of a bigger radical change in education, away from teacher-centered learning towards student-centered learning.
Well, we've only just scratched the surface, as I knew that we would, so I apologize for that, but I thank you all so much for your insights and for just really whetting our appetites to learn more about these exciting innovations. And certainly there are lots more questions to come, too. For example, one, Father Joe, I just got one from our tweeters, our education influencers, who say, is the sole purpose of education getting a job? That's obviously something that we're going to want to talk about. And you say, very briefly.
No.
Okay.
The sole purpose of education is to create well-rounded, competent, good citizens and good people who will change the world for the better. That's the goal of education, and we always have to keep that in mind. So the classical humanist idea still lives, I think.
Father Joe Parks is president of Cristo Rey New York High School. That's a Catholic high school in East Harlem, New York. Also with us, Larry Scripp, director for the Center for Music in Education. Jesse Willie Wilson is the CEO of Dreambox Learning. They were all kind enough to join us at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Thank you all so much for joining us. More to come.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Now we'd like to bring you the story of one young woman for whom going to school was literally an act of courage. Shabana Basij Rasik was 6 when the Taliban took over in Afghanistan. They made it illegal for girls to go to school. As a result, for years, Shabana and her sister put their lives on the line to go to a secret school in Kabul. Her persistence and bravery eventually led her to Middlebury College, where she graduated magna cum laude in 2010. Now she's co-founder of the School of Leadership Afghanistan. That's a nonprofit that helps young Afghan women access education around the world and jobs back in Afghanistan. And Shabana Basij Rasik is with us now from the Aspen Ideas Festival. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on everything
you've
accomplished.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here. The idea of being banned from going to school is one that I think many Americans just cannot fathom. And I understand that in order for you to go to school, you dressed as a boy to escort your older sister, who was not allowed to be outside alone. Could you just tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, as you know, Michelle, during Taliban, one of the things that was particularly difficult for the people of Afghanistan was this denial of rights for half of the population. Girls not being able to go to school, women not being allowed to go to job, and something that was very strange and new to a lot of people, certainly older generation. But scary in a way that for younger generation, it was a normal way of growing up because they had no comparison, no memory of what it could be like.
Who came up with the idea of dressing you as a boy?
In some ways it was, I'm a very petite person to begin with. So in some ways that helped my my older sister who had to go to a secret school, but walking outside she had to wear a burqa. So accompanying her, she couldn't be outside alone under Taliban. You could rarely see women walking alone outside. So in some ways, it was a strategy that helped both of us to receive an education. But what is so shocking to me to this day is that I grew up under a regime that banned education for young girls, I mean, for 6 years of their existence in Afghanistan. And today, well, a decade after the Taliban regime, you have millions of girls who continue to struggle to receive an education in one way or another. You know, to put it into context, we have illiteracy rate in Afghanistan is still skyrocketing, especially for women. You have around 90% of women in the country who have never been to a school. We talk about a country where maternal mortality rate is one of the highest in the world. You talk about a society where it's quite challenging for girls in rural Afghanistan to receive an education.
But why is that? It's because the schools don't exist, because their families won't permit them to go to school. And I do want to point out again that your father was a very strong champion of your going to school.
Absolutely.
That is a fact that cannot be overlooked. But why is it that the challenge still exists?
Well, to put it back in some ways to the American audience, can you ever imagine the United States going through more than 30 years of continuous war? One thing that I always try to tell people here is that please don't think Afghans being against education, because that's certainly not the case. That's something that I personally was challenged at a very young age when people, older men from with long beards and turbans from rural Afghanistan came to Kabul to my father and me from my father's village in eastern Afghanistan, trying to convince us how important it is for their daughters to receive an education. You know, because of these 30 years of war, people have always been busy trying to survive. A lot of places have never simply had a school for girls. If you go to a rural community in Afghanistan today and you talk about what is most needed, they will tell you the problems they have, lack of health care, and no access to provincial centers or to the market. You know, no education. They will tell you that not having a school for their children is a big problem. But if you ask them to prioritize the needs and what they want to accomplish first, they will definitely tell you they want a health clinic first. They want a road giving them access to provincial center. Education comes closer to the bottom of the list, not because they don't have a desire to receive an education or want their children to be educated, but at the moment, education is seen as a luxury that a lot of people cannot afford.
And we've skipped past some of the challenges that you experienced, in part because you want to focus on your work now and you don't want to make yourself the center of the story, but just mentioning that there were times when you would certainly have to disguise your books. There were times when school would be canceled because you feared that you were being followed. Again, all of these experiences that would be very alien to most of the people listening to our conversation now. Talk about your work now. And also, I think a lot of people would be interested to know, how can the international community help? I mean, as you pointed out, there are many, many people who would like their daughters and their sons to have an education, but they don't see a way forward. How can the international community help? And tell us about your work now.
Well, Michelle, I will make a connection to my childhood with Sola. I received an education under Taliban, and it was quite dangerous, and I was just very privileged that I had the supportive parents I have, who always pushed me to study, to risk my life and risk their life for them to receive an education. But what I see that's similar to even today in my students is that supportive parents. What is so amazing about our school, the School of Leadership Afghanistan, we're located in Kabul, but we have students from rural Afghanistan. The classic problem in Afghanistan is always the divide between opportunities and access to opportunities in cities versus rural Afghanistan. It's always been more challenging for women. So bringing young girls from provinces to receive a quality education in Kabul is what we focus on. And yet you see that a lot of parents continue to take a lot of risks on their behalf and to make sure that they are able to receive an education. I have students who come from places like Helmand and Kunar province and Bamiyan and other parts of the country where access to education for young girls is quite rare. And yet it's the parents and oftentimes the father figure who takes the risk and tells the daughter that you go and receive this education in Kabul and I will take care of whether it's the backbiting, the bad-mouthing, or even often risks and threats from the Taliban to make sure that their education is possible.
How can others help?
A lot of ways. I'll have to say very quickly that there are 66 million girls in the world who are waiting to be sent to school. A lot of those girls live in Afghanistan today. We cannot move forward. We cannot rely on a sustainable development in Afghanistan unless we equip young people with quality education. I mean, here in the Aspen Ideas Festival, we talk about incorporating technology into education and so many other ways. But talk about a country where people have just their geographic problem, their security problems, that they cannot receive an education. So ways to help, it always financial contributions matter, but think about educators. They can always come to Afghanistan to teach students, people who can mentor students, get interested in sponsor their education and so on. So there are ways to help.
Thank you so much for joining us. Shabana Basij-Rasik is co-founder of the School of Leadership Afghanistan. She was kind enough to join us during our special broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. Shabana Basij-Rasik, thank you so much for joining us. A continued success in your work.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. Today, as we broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado, we decided to talk about new ideas about how young people can make the most of their 20s. These days, you will hear a lot of criticism of this group, the so-called millennials. Many critics scorn 20-somethings as unfocused, self-centered, even lazy. Others praise their free-spirited sense of adventure, exploring different relationships and careers without settling down. Now, though, others are saying that all that freedom is not free, and many Americans need to rethink what their 20s are for. Joining us here in Aspen to talk about this, Meg Jay. She is a clinical psychologist. She's author of the book, The Defining Decade, about thriving during your 20s. She's also a mom of two. Daniel Kim is the 33-year-old founder and CEO of Lit Motors. That's a sustainable transportation company. And Dr. Pamela Cantor is a psychiatrist. She works with children. She's the CEO of Turnaround for Children, which helps improve low-performing schools. She's also a mom of five and grandmother of 15. Welcome to you all. Thank you all so much for joining us. Yes, you wear the crown. Meg Jay, I'm going to start with you because you gave a very popular TED Talk earlier this year. It was viewed more than 2 million times. Yes. You said that 20-somethings are kicking the can down the road when it comes to relationships, work, and other parts of life. I wanted to ask, you know, how you started thinking about that and how you came to that conclusion.
Yes. Well, I'm a clinical psychologist, and I specialize in 20-somethings. So all day, every day, I sit across from 20-somethings, and I listen to them. And what I have found is that, of course, young adults settle down later than they used to, and there are many upsides to that. But I think it's hard when a young adult is trying to think about time, that when they hear that partnership happens later, career happens later, adulthood happens later, then they sort of lose that urgency and that purpose of what am I supposed to do with my 20s. And then I think that's hard. That leaves a lot of 20-somethings feeling quite aimless when they really want to be taken seriously and they want to get started on their life.
I think a lot of 20-somethings will be hearing our conversation, also parents of 20-somethings, who will say that the economy is the reason that a lot of young people are unfocused
sure.
today. That's just not their choice, that they've not settled into the career of their choice or even the career that they've trained for. That they've got to have two or three part-time gigs just to fill their day because they can't find that. So what about that? Is it a choice
sure.
or is it they're just reacting to the circumstances that they've been given?
Right. Well, 20-somethings are a diverse group, so I would not say, you know, it's all a choice or it's all circumstance. But, you know, I think graduating into a recession is not fun, but it's a time to learn about what you do when the wind isn't at your back. And right now the wind is not at 20-somethings' backs. And yes, you may have to have different part-time gigs to pay your bills, and that's the way it was for me when I graduated, which was not long after the 87 crash. But you can still use that time to keep yourself relevant to what you want to do or what you want to do next. You don't have to leave college and go straight into some great high-paying job to make it down the line.
Daniel Kim, you're our honorary 20-something. Even though you're in our 30s. But you, the reason we're so happy that you could join us is that you had a path that a lot of people would consider very unconventional. You dropped out of college to become a mechanic. You were laid off from that job, and then you traveled the world. And then you re-enrolled in college and started a company. So I wanted to ask just how the conversation we've had so far, how is that resonating with you and the people you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely can identify with that path. You know, I'm Asian. My parents, you know, were very hard on me to become a doctor or an engineer or a concert pianist. So, you know, I took an opposite direction. But, you know, dropping out of Reed was probably one of the best things that I ever did. But one thing that stayed throughout my entire 20s was I remained to be very curious. And definitely was very proactive in assuaging that like desire to be incredibly you know satisfied with knowledge. So,
did you think that one of the points that Dr. Jay makes in her book is that kids these days are told, young people these days are told that 30 is the new 20 or 20. What is it? Is it 20 is the new 30?
They hear 30 is the new 20.
30 is the new 20, which essentially saying you've got 10 years to mess around. Did you feel that way, that you had 10 years to mess around?
Yeah. Well, not really mess around, but a lot of my friends are definitely, you know, kind of taking that route. It's kind of easy. You know, there's no real, like, no one really wants, a lot of my friends don't want to work in large corporations, and they kind of despise the that path. So, you know, for me, creating my own startup was something that I could kind of sink my teeth into. It was a big project. It basically took up all my time, about 17 hours every day. So, you know, I had a lot of fun, and I was just passionate about it, and I loved it, and I didn't really love learning about, you know, the Iliad, which was great. You know, I think everyone should go through the classics, just know your own historical background, at least for Western culture. But, I really felt that just this concept of being engaged and, finding ways to be resourceful. Is really important. Yes.
Dr. Cantor, you guided your own children, now your grandchildren through their 20s. Do you think this generation is really all that different from the 20-somethings who came before?
Well, I actually do, but I look at it through the parent-child lens, in the sense that if I were to make one broad statement about the millennials, it has to do with how much failure their parents tolerated. By that I mean that failure is often a really incredible opportunity if kids are allowed to have it. And I would say, both from the family perspective and my practice perspective, the tolerance for kids failing was very low. And the requirement for kids to do something unusual, very high. So where my parents were really happy for me to have an advantage they didn't have, being a doctor was a great thing. Not so much. Our kids feel, and grandkids certainly, that they have to do something very unusual.
But, well, Scott Rocco, for example, tweets, weren't the same things said about Gen X that are being said about millennials now? Yes, no?
I actually don't think so. And I think this issue of calibration of failure is a huge part of that.
Meg Jay, what did you want to say?
I think the same things were being said about Gen X. I'm Gen X, and I think, you know, the path that Danny's talking about is very similar to my path. I graduated from college, great school, University of Virginia, graduated into a recession, couldn't get a job that required a college degree, so I became an Outward Bound instructor, which had a lot of identity capital, didn't make a lot of money, but it helped me get into Berkeley.
When you say identity capital, stop right there. Tell us what you mean by that.
By identity capital, it's a sociologist's term, but it means that it's something that said a lot about who I was, what I was capable of, what I was about, and what I might want to do next. So I had a lot of grit. And it said a lot about my commitment to working with people, being willing to work hard. And so when I went to go to graduate school at Berkeley, that really helped me. And I think sometimes 20-somethings see a false choice. You were talking about false choices earlier in the program between starting their life and, you know, I have to go work in a corporation or I'm completely drop out of it. And there's a lot in between. That's what Danny's talking about.
Is this a privileged conversation? Because I am thinking about the fact that, you know, today I think many of us are very aggrieved and really sad and hurt about the death of those 19 firefighters in Arizona. 14 of those 19 people who died were in their 20s.
Absolutely.
And I'm thinking about the people who are landing the planes on aircraft carriers, the people who are guiding those planes onto aircraft carriers, the people who are kind of on the front lines are in their 20s,
right.
You know, by and large.
Mm-hmm.
So is this a privileged conversation? Is this a conversation about people who kind of have enough resources somewhere that they can contemplate not having a direction at a certain age. Danny, I mean, I don't know.
I'm not going to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
Aren't you sweet? That's definitely, my conversation is definitely not a privileged conversation. It is not. The entire reason I wrote my book was that I believed that anybody who could scrape together $10 should have access to the information that my students were getting at UVA, that they got at Berkeley, or that my clients were getting. And one of the most gratifying things about having written a book about how to make the most of your 20s, it's been incredibly popular with 20-somethings of color, with 20-somethings of all different socioeconomic backgrounds who have said, I would have given anything to have a helicopter parent, and I'm just so glad somebody is giving me a place to start.
Dr. Cantor, and also I want to mention, if you still want to join our conversation, if you missed your flight to Aspen, you can join us at #NPRAspen. Dr. Cantor, you see a difference between boys and girls, young men and young women in this conversation.
I actually don't. I think it's very, very similar. And I agree with this notion that Meg was talking about, that the absence of opportunity in the 20s because of the recession is actually providing a very wonderful irritant to a lot of creative thinking about what kids want to do with their lives. So to me, that's the moment of failure that becomes opportunity that they have absolutely been craving.
Danny Kim, can you talk a little bit about how you, when you were spending that time kind of dealing with yourself, if I could put it that way, and exploring different things, did you kind of think you had a goal in mind, or how did you think about the time that you were spending and what you were doing?
A lot of it was really just kind of very intuitive. You know, when, after I dropped out of Reed, I was like, well, what do I want to do? What am I most curious about? I wanted to learn how cars worked, like deep down. So I applied to become a mechanic, and I convinced the head lead mechanic of a Land Rover shop to give me a job. I mean, I had no experience, like zero. Did that for a year and a half, and then I was like, well, I'm done with that. Now what am I curious about? Well, I'm curious about the world. So I'd saved up a lot of money.
I was going to say, where did you live during all this time?
I was in Portland, Oregon. Yeah.
Were you with the Bank of Mom and Dad at that point?
No. I was living on my own. You know, they definitely came to visit, but you know, yeah, absolutely, or something like that. You know, I left. So we went on a family vacation to Spain, and I just did not come back. So that was an interesting conversation. It's time to pack your bags. That's interesting. Well, I'm going to go over to Germany. She's like, but we're going back to Portland. I'm like, well, I'm going to go to Germany. And she's like, well, you know, how are you going to do that? What money? Well, I have $11,000 in my debit card. And then she's like, well, how are you going to eat? It's like, I'm going to go buy food. And, you know, but that led to about a year of travel by myself. And, you know, when you talk about, like, identity capital, it's just... I mean, really, like, traveling to 106 cities, 28 countries by myself, you know, I traveled
alone. I know
that
people would want to come to you. I mean, if you were in a, like, a room full of people, I know that I would gravitate to you because I know you'd have some interesting stories to tell. But yeah. I do want to ask, when did you decide it was over and it was time for you to come back and get on the track?
I never got back on track. Yeah.
But you did go back to college.
Yeah, I applied to Berkeley and got in for, like, architecture and then dropped out and then because that wasn't where I wanted to do. And then... I started building my own trucks after that, just because that's what I wanted to do in the beginning, and I took it about a year and a half to basically to build two vehicles in a tandem production. The idea was to use the DIY, the maker kind of community.
Well, when you think about that time now, how do you think it contributed to the person you are today? Or was it good time or was it wasted time when you're honest with us and yourself?
Oh, it was great. I mean, being able to, like, understand what deep fear was, like running with the bulls, like actually running with the bulls. It's a great way to kind of test yourself and really understand, you know, how do I react in a situation like that. So, I was very comfortable with myself in a very deep, meaningful level.
We have time just for some last-minute advice from
Of
you. Dr. Kennedy, you want to start us off? And obviously, if you're speaking now to people who are listening to this conversation and maybe aren't sure where they fit in this or what to say to a 20-something or a 20-something themselves, what do you want to say?
I think my focus would certainly be wanting them to like to really be able to see the opportunity that is in front of them. And sometimes that's guided by curiosity, but sometimes it's really guided by disappointment. So to not be afraid to use that disappointment to create something.
Yeah, you've got a whole book of advice.
I do. But, I guess that would be my first piece, would read the book.
Would reread the book, but just in the time that we have here. What's your advice to people who are thinking about this, not sure they're on the right track, not sure they're saying the right things?
Right. You know, I think the one kind of life that I'm advocating, because 20-somethings are such a diverse group, it's not a one-size-fits-all anymore. And because of that, you need to be more intentional, not less intentional, because there's not a turnkey life waiting for you whenever you decide to you want one. So, you know, I think it's really just lead an intentional life and that process starts in your 20s and it will unfold over time.
That time does matter.
Absolutely.
Meg Jay is author of the book, The Defining Decade. It's Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now. She is a clinical psychologist. Daniel Kim is founder and CEO of Lit Motors. Dr. Pamela Cantor is CEO of Turnaround for Children, which helps improve underperforming schools. They were all kind enough to join us here at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Finally, today we want to take a minute to say goodbye to an important figure in American politics and education. Former Congressman William Gray III died yesterday at the age of 71. Gray was a Democrat who represented Pennsylvania's 2nd District from 1979 to 1992. He was the first African American to serve as majority whip in the U.S. House of Representatives. Gray was a mentor for a generation of black politicians in Philadelphia, but his service did not end when he left Congress. He went on to serve as CEO of the United Negro College Fund, where he raised hundreds of millions of dollars to support the education of African American students and the institutions that served them. And while he'll be honored by the country for his contributions to politics, he'll also be remembered in Philadelphia as pastor of Bright Hope Baptist Church until 2007. His former aide said he used to commute back to the city from Washington to deliver the Sunday sermon. In a statement, current Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter remembered Gray's ease with people from all walks of life, saying he knew guys on the corner and he knew Nelson Mandela and everyone in between. Former Congressman William H. Gray III died yesterday at the age of 71. And that's our program for today. Special thanks to our team in Aspen. Our lead producer was Emily Oxenschlager with Amitha Parasher and Bridget Deshagas in Washington. Senior producer Devar Ardalan moderated our live Twitter chat. Our editor is Ahmad Omar. Our technical director here in Aspen is Neil Tivault. Thanks to Melissa Marquis and Greg Gavin in Washington, D.C. Arjun Hutchins is directing from Washington. Our acting executive producer is Carlene Watson. Ellen McDonald is the executive editor of News Programming. Thanks to our hosts at Aspen Public Radio and to the Aspen Ideas Festival for all of their support. And thanks to you for participating online at hashtag NPR Aspen. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. Remember to tell us more. Go to npr.org/tellmemore. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The handle is @tellmemorenpr. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tune in for more talk tomorrow.